Hello and welcome to Talk to Me with me, Shane Maloney, a show where I seek out interesting and accomplished people who have thought-provoking stories to tell. My guest today is Commodore Ronald W. Warwick, who is one of a select group of people which have commanded one of the greatest ships ever to have been built, the Queen Elizabeth II. In my conversation with Ron, we discuss why he chose a life at sea, his family connection to the QE2, and his memories of serving on and commanding that great ship. We also talk about how he became master of the Queen Mary II, his role in the design and build of that vessel, and how he received a ticket for the chance of a lifetime to dive on the wreck of the Titanic. Ron has a treasure trove of memories, so join me in my conversation with Commodore Ron Warwick as we discuss all of the above and much more. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Ron as much as I did. All right, good. Listen, thank you for your time today, Ron. Greatly appreciate it. And as I said earlier on, I said I'd kick off by asking you, why did you choose a life at sea? What inspired you to choose that life?
Well, it's not really a very exciting story. I was one of these kids that really didn't know what he wanted to do when he was very young. My father moved around a bit and I went to quite a few different schools. And of course, he was away a lot. And when he used to come home, he kept bugging me, asking me what I wanted to do so he could channel my education in that direction. And eventually I said, well, I'll go to sea. And he said, well, it's not a bad job. So I went to a training school called HMS Conway up in North Wales, and spent 2 years there, and then signed my father indentured me to a shipping company called the Port Line, and it went from there.
For those who don't know, your father, do you want to do a quick, I know a little bit of the history, and I know he has a relationship to the ship behind you as well, but maybe you just want to tell us a little bit about your father.
My father was born in 1912. He was actually born in a pub in overlooking the Mersey in Liverpool. And he went away to the Conway as well, the school. And then he signed in indentures and spent the rest of his working life at sea. He spent most of his life, early life, over in India, ships trading out that way. And then came back to England in the late 1930s, and then he joined Cunard Line, and that was the beginning of his career with them. And he went on to serve on most of the ships of the day, and then sailed on the Queen Elizabeth as master, and Queen Mary as master, Mauritania as master, and then was appointed the first master of the Queen Elizabeth II, and he was in the shipyard there from the late 60s right through to the time he retired in the early 70s.
Yeah. Very good. So there's a family business, really, isn't it? QE2, yeah. In a way.
It was quite unique, actually. I've studied a lot of old records and accumulated a vast amount of information about, like biographic information about captains in Cunard Line going back to 1840. And there's never been another occasion when a father and son have actually commanded the same ship in the fleet.
Yeah, and what a ship to take command of, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, stunning. Okay, thank you. So let's talk about that old lady behind you, because there really is only one, and the reaction and the fondness in which people hold that particular ship is it's almost irrational in a way. I mean, people absolutely adore it. Do you have any idea what made it so particularly special? Was it something intrinsic to the ship, or was it the time at which it applied its trade?
Well, I think probably from my point of view, as it was sort of in the family, I had probably a little bit of a different view on it in the early days. Although having said that, I really wasn't interested in the ship while it was being built. I was working in the freight side of it. I was in cargo ships running out to Jamaica, and was quite comfortable out there. And the only reason I got interested in it is when my father's name appeared in the newspaper, appointing him as master designate. And I cut that press cutting and put it in my collection, which was nothing to do with ships. It was purely genealogical. I was sort of tracing the family tree. So I put that in that file. And then there were more and more press cuttings, which he was featured in during the construction years with his photograph. And of course, I'm hoarding these things up and gradually getting interested in the ship, but not enough to take me away from the company I work for. I work for a Jamaican company. And then one day I was in Kingston, Jamaica on my ship, and the QE2 was coming in on her maiden cruising season. So being my dad was there, it wasn't difficult for me to get on board. I just couldn't believe my eyes what I saw. You know, I mean, compared to the freighter I was on, this was just no comparison, you know, sort of bridge with a carpet down and, you know, lots of officers in uniform running around left, right and center, immaculate service, everything brand new, of course. I just couldn't believe it. I told my dad, you know, I said, you've got to go to sea, there's only one ship to go on, and that was the QE2. And so I applied for a position and joined about 3 or 4 months later as a junior officer.
Very good. And did you join the QE2, or was it a different, did you work on different Cunard ships before you?
No, I joined the QE2. It was my first appointment, but only to do what they call the standby. The ship came into port. My father was in command, and it went straight into dry dock. And then he went on vacation, and I stayed there for a couple of weeks, and then I was transferred to the Carmania. So we didn't actually sail together. We just did that one day's work together. And then I didn't go back to the QE2 until he retired a few years later.
So what position did you join when you went on board?
A chief officer on the freighters, but I had to go to the bottom again. So I joined as a junior third officer with a master's ticket, of course, and gradually worked my way up. I rose fairly rapidly, I have to admit.
Actually, that's interesting, because that is one of the things that crossed my mind was the QE2. I think if you decide you want a life in passenger ships, I think the QE2 and the QM2, which we can talk about later, is pretty much the pinnacle. And I was wondering, you know, why Ron Warwick? Why did Ron rise to the top and become that part of that very, very select group of people who were master of that wonderful ship?
Well, anybody you talk to who's been at sea and for any length of time in whatever position, you know, whether it's the galley boy or the stoker or the officer on watch or an engineer, will tell you that you have to work very hard on a ship. You have to have a good work culture. You know, there's no such a thing as a day off on shipboard. And if you get sick or ill or something like that and attempted to take a day off, it just means somebody else is going to do your work. So you get, so everyone really worked hard. And of course, I was just one of them. I worked hard, but I stood the course. You know, there's a lot of people through circumstances, no fault of their own, move on. You know, they become ill or have to leave, or they get married and their wives don't want them to stay at sea. So
life changes.
I worked hard, but there's always a certain amount of luck in it.
Right place at the right time, type of thing.
Yeah.
So what was a typical day on board? We say when you were master of the QE2, what was a typical day on board like?
Well, on the Atlantic runs, which I really enjoyed, when you leave the UK and head out to New York, and the days are different because you're actually sailing fairly quickly through numerous weather patterns. It could be like a mill pond one day and stormy seas the other, or thick fog, especially over on the western side of the Atlantic. But it's the ship is like a small company. I mean, there we had in the region of 1,000 crew members, up to 1,200 sometimes. And as master, as captain, you are head of that company, and you're protecting the safety of life at sea and the safety of the ship, and also making sure the ship is operating commercially viable for the owners. So there's a great responsibility. Obviously, you've got people helping you with that. You've got like a chief engineer, very senior man on the ship, who looks after every aspect of the engineering and the domestic operations of the ship of a mechanical nature. And then you have a hotel manager who looks after everything from the accommodation to the catering. So you've got those two principal people working for you, plus a deputy captain. So you're really like the CEO, really, of a small company. And, okay. At sea, you know, if the weather was fine, you'd have a little bit more time to go around the ship and look at various aspects of operation. You know, I mean, it's a lot of commercial elements go on board the ship, as you probably know. You know, from you know, you might get a notification that the casino is not bringing in enough money, so you have to look into that and find out why, and then you might find that one of the croupiers is being grumpy and he doesn't like it, or the photographer's income has dropped off, and things like that, you know.
And you would get that level of detail of reporting to you?
Yes, everything was monitored, very, very commercial. So at the end of each voyage, you'd get like a commercial report of how much all the different departments, a lot of money generating areas on the ship, you know, from the bars, the beauty salon, the hairdressers, and spa, things like that. The photographers all generating funds, casinos. So you would look at those, and obviously there's, over the years, a trend builds into it. You know, you say, well, that's the average income for this type of crossing, you know, and that would be dependent on, say, the weather. You know, if it was a really rough crossing, you're obviously not going to make so much money in the bars than you would on a lovely calm day when everyone's out and on deck drinking pina colada or something like that.
Absolutely. You know? Only diehards would be in the bar in rough weather.
But then there are other things as well, you know, well, you know, as an engineer, you realise that the faster an engine runs, the more fuel it consumes, you know, so we want to be careful watching the speed that the ship went, you know, not to sort of go like a bat out of hell and get there early and slow down. We want to try and keep the revs as low as possible, and allowing for sort of contingencies of weather. And then things of that nature. So there's a lot of different things to do. And then apart from the commercial element, you usually have a meeting most mornings with the heads of departments, and then there'd be various inspections going on, which are required by the Merchant Shipping Act of accommodation and work areas like the galleys and things like that. And then, of course, there's always the social element, you know, a lot of cocktail parties, which weren't a problem. It was just par for the course. But you might have you might have the media on board, press that were often sailing on the ship, you know, and they'd want interviews and looks at different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or or even groups of travel agents would come. So, you know, obviously, because we're commercially orientated, you want to push your wear and tears to the best advantage.
Yeah. And did you, I mean, how was your, because I have an interest as well, obviously, in the vessel and marine background, but from a management point of view, and it's very interesting to hear you speak about the, you know, liking it to being a CEO and managing a large organization. What was it, a typical structure of the day? I mean, you're crossing time zones. Would you wake at the same time every morning? Would you kind of have the morning meeting at the same time every day? Or would things vary depending on where you were in the world?
Well, things like meetings with heads of departments and various other organisations on board that we had to deal with, like health and safety meetings or health and hygiene meetings. These were all structured well in advance. The calendar of events would be put out before the beginning of the voyage, so they were always programmed on a day-to-day basis. And then other things, you know, like especially some of the financial issues or problems with passengers or that may have something they're not happy with, you know, they were dealt with on a day-to-day basis. And then, of course, there was a primary responsibility or second prime, it's the safety of the ship. So, you know, if the weather was really rough, one would spend more time on the bridge. You know, especially if it was foggy, then you'd be on there pretty well all the time until visibility cleared up. And so a normal day after the first day at sea after sailing, I mean, my pattern was always to be up and about by 7, but quite often I'd get up at 6 and I knew my way around the ship pretty well, so I could structure a good walk around within half an hour or 20 minutes. And at that time of the day, it's very quiet, you know, because it's nice stopping and talking to passengers, but it would curtail what you wanted to achieve.
So you've got a day's work to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Early in the morning, I could go around and see as much as I possibly could. So it was usually, but I would always be up and about at 7 and go to the bridge to see everything gone all right overnight. And then the day would just go on and things like cocktail receptions for the passengers, they would start around about 5 o'clock, because you've got, you know, over 1,000 people, so that would be split up into 2, and then dinner later. So often dinner wouldn't end till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. So it's quite a long day, really.
I was going to say it's quite a long day, and that's day in, day out, really. Yeah.
And then going to port, you know, like arriving in New York, you're always up and about there by at least by 4 in the morning, you know, as you're approaching the harbour, and depending on lots of different circumstances, could be earlier, but very, very rarely later.
So you just mentioned about approaching New York and leaving port and sailing, particularly the manoeuvring side of things. Your time, you were there both when it was steam turbine and diesel electric. Yeah, you've experienced both.
Correct. Yeah. Steam turbine was, I suppose you could say, a more precise operation, in that, you know, if you're bashing across the ocean at 28.5 knots, you generated a lot of superheated steam. So when it came to stop, the last thing you wanted to do was just put the brakes on and blow all the valves and heat. Reduce the heat too quickly. So we had a planned slowdown arrangement there, and it was usually 2 hours. So you had to adjust your arrival at the harbour entrance and start slowing down 2 hours before. In contrast with the diesel electric plant, it was just a couple of levers and
Yeah, forward, back, on, off.
Yeah, so it was a lot more efficient. Made a lot of difference to us that, you know, it's certainly in arrivals and departures and manoeuvring in general.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would imagine with the diesel electric and the controllable pitch propellers, manoeuvring must have been much easier.
Yes, it was. I mean, nothing as easy as it is today now with the azipod propulsion they had, but certainly it was much better. And the beauty of it was that the engine was turning in the same direction all the time, and you just changed the pitch of the propellers. Whereas with the steam turbine, you actually had to stop it and then apply the steam on the reverse blades. So there was always that interval. So in a way, if you were approaching the port, you'd have to think of stopping, you know, quite a long way before.
Yeah, looking well far ahead, trying to work out and anticipate what you're going to do.
Yeah.
So I know it's something that you're working on at the moment, and we take some time to maybe talk about it, was the Falklands campaign. I believe you were on board at the time, yeah?
Yeah, that you know, it's nearly 38 years ago now, isn't it? This month, we were on our way down there. I was a chief officer at the time on there. And I've always said it was one of the busiest times in my seagoing career. You know, every day was sort of action packed with something, right from the preparation and the voyage down there. And I did write quite a bit about it in a book that I wrote about the QE2 many years ago, and updated it. To the fourth edition, which came out a couple of years ago. And it was while I was doing the revising and updating and reading the Falkland chapter again, I just felt that there's a lot more to that story that could be told. I sort of investigated what information's out there, and then decide to go ahead just shortly before Christmas. It's I've been trawling the Facebook pages, as you know, and it's surprising what I've come up with there, little snippets of information. You know, it's really, really quite amazing. I put a questionnaire out to people to jog their memories, and coming up with some nice little anecdotes.
So maybe for those who don't really know the background, Ron, I mean, the situation was, so you had Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands, and there was a decision made to go and to retake those, and there was a need for troop transports, basically.
Yes, well, they already had some people down there by the time we left, but they needed some support because this is an extraordinary war, really. You know, at the time, the junta in Argentina always felt that it was their island and they wanted it back, and they were carrying out some exercises around that time. And also at the same time, the HMS Endurance, which was the sort of guard ship there, come South Atlantic service, it was there, and the government of the day was talking about withdrawing that. So there's a few different things that went on that probably made the junta think, oh well, this is a good time to move in. But what they did was that Britain would take umbrage at that approach and send all this mighty force down there. Yeah. But the thing was, you know, that QE2's role was very, very small part of the jigsaw puzzle. And when I was in Florida a couple of months ago, I borrowed several books from the library, and there's actually probably well over 100 books written about the war. But Fury 2 barely gets a mention, maybe a sentence or half a sentence. So, you know, compared to the war as a whole and the losses and things that went on, it's not a very big part. But the way I see it is that everybody on the QE2, 600 plus, they all volunteered for this voyage, you know, and although they didn't actually get into battle, if you like, or weren't shot at or in sort of danger from the enemy, they still played an important part. So the book won't focus on the war. It'll just be about what we did, going down there, getting the troops off, bringing the survivors back, and as a tribute to the crew. That's how it's.
I mean, you say not in danger, but of course, when you volunteer for something unknown, you have no idea what you're heading into. So,
yeah, well, that's right, you know. But at the time, well, you're probably a bit too young to remember it, but at the time, the country was very united. You know, Mrs. Thatcher saying, "Well, you know, why should it belongs to us? They can't have it. You know, not going to have it." And you know, both sides of the house sort of agreed, and off we all went. You know, and they had the arguments when we came back.
Yeah, because you guys, were you cruising, or you just finished a transatlantic crossing?
Well,
and then it all happened really quickly.
We'd had a transatlantic, but instead of going to New York, we'd gone to Philadelphia. There was a big event in Philadelphia. So it was when we were coming back along the English Channel that the ship was requisitioned by the government. And then there was about six, seven days of conversion to take all the hardware and helicopters and things of that nature. So it was a pretty active time.
Yeah, and I'm just digging into my memory. I believe when the vessel was being constructed, there was a loan from the government to complete it. And I think one of the clauses there was that it would be potentially taken up, requisitioned, if required.
Well,
or am I misremembering?
No, it's not. It's not totally correct, and it's not totally incorrect. It's one of those things.
Okay.
Any British registered ship can be requisitioned by the British government. You know, that's every ship is registered, and QE2 was registered in Southampton, and that was one of the things that went with it. So, if there was something written in the contract, then I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
I haven't heard.
If you're on the register, then you potentially can get requisitioned. Okay.
Yeah.
So I would imagine there was a huge amount of work, well, just even from the deck officer's point of view, to preparations and planning and.
Well, there was, you know, because they cut big chunks of the ship away to make way for the helicopter landing platforms, and you know that extra weight was quite considerable. So one of the main responsibilities that I had was to monitor the stability of the ship, you know, as all this aluminium was going off and steel coming on, and all the ammunition and stores. And in fact, I dedicated one officer entirely. That's all his job for the whole 6 or 7 days, was to calculate as best he could what went off and what came on. So we would know that we were stable. And the ship was actually what we call below the marks, below the pencil line when we left. And we had to get a dispensation from the authorities before we sailed. But it was still a safe margin, you know. So that was probably one of the main responsibilities that we had. For getting it. And then the troops came on, and They were just amazing. There's like 3,500. They were all over the place, those guys. They never stopped exercising. They were really, really fit when they came on, and they were equally as fit when they went off. You know, it wasn't like a sunshine cruise to the south for them.
I can only imagine, yeah. And was the work done alongside in Southampton? Or
yes, it was all done there. Bosper Thornycross did most of the contracting work. They did made the steel helicopter landing platforms. There were two of those, one on the bow and one in the on the after end over the two swimming pools. Things like that. An extra radio station was put on, you know, sort of top secret one, you know. So, you know, for the strategic element of it. Yeah, so lots of different supplies for the troops. Yeah, and then lots of things went off, of course. We didn't need potted plants on the ship, and we didn't need the casino, and we didn't need the dancing girls, and sure, the troops would have liked it, but we didn't need the beauty salon staff. We kept a couple of barbers on, you know, things like that, but you know, anyone that was not required, because they weren't passengers. I mean, they were, but they were on a mission, you know. So we reduced the crew to about 600 from about 1,000, 1,100 would have been the normal complement.
And I'm guessing a lot of the artwork and things like that, which was on board, was taken off as well.
Yes, so a lot of the things were taken off like that. a lot of the carpets were covered with hardboard to protect them. The shops, they bailed out their expensive watches and jewels and things. They didn't need those. And they took the caviar off, of course.
Very good. What about operations which you guys wouldn't have been used to doing, for example, replenishment at sea? Did you undertake any of those?
Yeah, that was quite a challenge for the ministry when they converted the ship, because all warships are built with that facility in place. Well, we couldn't have openings down near the waterline because of the danger. So we had to use one of the gangway openings, which is up on two deck. You know, that's like 50 feet above the waterline. So that's where the pipe would come in from the replenishment provider. But then to get it down to the tanks, we had to drop a pipe, a big steel pipe, all the way down through the middle of the ship, which was welded in place. And then when we set sail from Southampton, we tried it out and took on a couple of tons, and it worked okay. And then we went south, and we had enough fuel to keep us going until we left South Georgia and come back, and then we replenished then and took a load of fuel on from one of the RFA fleet tankers. But that was quite an interesting exercise, because the weather wasn't very good, you know. And
I would imagine, from a ship handling and manoeuvring point of view, that was an interesting few hours.
Well, actually, the roles of the procedure were reversed. Normally, when a naval ship goes on to get replenished, the tanker maintains its course and speed, and the the naval ship will then maneuver to keep in the right position. But because of our size and less maneuverability, we maintained our course, and the captain of the fleet tanker had to make sure that he kept at the right distance and the right speed, things like that. So but like all these things, you know, it's teamwork, very coordinated effort. Anything on the ship is teamwork. It wouldn't work any other way.
Yeah. And you had some, I'm guessing you had some Royal Navy officers on board as well, seconded for the duration?
Yes, there was what they call a Royal Navy party that was put on board, and that was some seamen and naval officers. And there was one naval captain, Captain Jimmy James, he came on, and he didn't take command of the ship, but he was in, I suppose you could say, in strategic command. He's the one that received all the information from Whitehall about what was happening and whether are there any dangers out there. So he would advise Captain Peter Jackson what was going on and whether we should go a bit slower or faster or start zigzagging and things like that nature. Other officers in that naval party were flight specialists. They dealt with the landing of the helicopters and things like that. So, and they stayed with us throughout the voyage there and back. Yeah.
Okay. And were you aware of any specific threat to the vessel during the course of your time down there?
Well, we got down near Ascension, and there was, characteristic Russian trawler out there with, aerials instead of nets.
Fishing for everything except fish.
Yeah, that was reported in. And but we got down to South Georgia quite safely. Bear in mind that, South Georgia's, about 450 miles away from the Falklands, which was the theatre of war, so we were quite safe there. When we got there, we transferred all our troops and the ammunition and everything else we had, or most of it, over to two other naval ships and the Canberra, which was down there. But as far as I remember, while we were down there, there was some concern about the Argentinian aircraft having a refueling in the air capability. So they were a bit worried about that. So we did leave a couple of days earlier, I think, than we scheduled, and then dropped the rest of the ammunition off on Ascension on the way up. But apart from that, everything was okay. Probably the worst moment in danger was the rumours, because there was no communications. Once we set sail, there was no communications for the crew. We couldn't phone out or send messages or anything like that. Was closed for incoming. So I think we got sort of down in the South Atlantic, and then there was a rumour flying around that the ship had been hit. We're sort of sailing down there through the ocean blue quite comfortably, and knowing that that's not, so we were all right, but then your mind goes back to the people you've left at home. If that rumour got, they'd be frantic, wouldn't they?
Of course.
I think that was the time when reality hit, for me, I was so absorbed in the work, and then all of a sudden you start thinking about what are the people hearing at home.
So when did you guys get back home to the UK?
Well, we weren't away very long. It was just over a month altogether. We went down there. But by the time we got down there, some ships had been sunk, and we took on board crews of three sunken ships, the Ardent, the Antelope, and the Coventry. So we took those because they didn't have a ship. The ships had been sunk. And then one of the captains was Alan West, and he went on to become the first Sea Lord, and now is Admiral Sir Lord Admiral Lord Alan West. So and I'm still in touch with him.
Very good. Okay.
Yeah,
because he was probably one of the youngest captains down there.
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah, he actually was the youngest one. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, as you said, it's such an unusual conflict in a way. It's in so many different ways. From a naval warfare point of view, it's probably the only kind of battle in the missile age, really.
Yeah.
Full scale conflict.
Well, as I say, there's dozens and dozens of books written about it, and looking at it from very different points of view. I know I was able to borrow quite a lot of these books from the library when I was over in Florida, you know, and I borrowed books that were written by Argentinians and also by British authors who write that type of book, but had gone over to Argentina and a few years later and talked to people. And in essence, you know, it probably should never have happened, but, you know, diplomacy, didn't necessarily go out of the window, but it was more difficult in those days, you know, to communicate. You know, we didn't have Zoom.
The internet was not born yet. Anything
like that, you know. So, but that must have been the case in wars throughout the passage of time, wasn't it? Yeah. But nevertheless, you know, I think with these things, you just have to look at simply, you know, was it worth it? You start asking that, and it's more difficult to answer. But if you just say, well, who did it belong to? You say, well, it belonged to the United Kingdom. Well, who should have it? We should. And that's it.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose as you said, it's a difficult question, and it all depends on who you ask, I suppose, the answer that you get.
You know, I mean, it was very sad. People died. Lots of the Argentinians died, you know, when the Belgrano was shot, was sunk. No one likes to hear stories like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, it's nonetheless a fascinating period in history and period in the life of the vessel and your career in particular. Is there anything, I mean, I'm sure there's so many highlights of spending so much time on board the QE2 working and being the master. Is there anything else in the life of being on board that ship that particularly stands out in your mind as a something to remember?
The first thing I should ask you is, have you read the book?
I haven't actually, Ron. No, I need to try and get my hands on a copy of it. Any chance I could get a signed copy from the author?
Picture on the front is the same one at the back.
Oh, so it is. So it is, yes.
And then perhaps you're a bit more familiar with that one. Wait a minute.
So there we go. Oh, yeah, yes. I'm very familiar with that one. I actually, just beside me, I have that photograph, actually. Myself and my wife were on board for my 40th birthday. It was a present from her. It only just opened. And we've got a few photographs taken.
I gave us permission to use that. So that tells this, it's like a diary of the ship, you know, all the things that happened to it over nearly 40 years. And the Falkland voyage is just one element, you know, and then there's the world cruises and storms and hurricanes and, you know, stowaways and bomb scares, everything like that, you know.
Tell me the one about the bomb scare, because I've heard little bits and pieces about this one.
Well, I was a second officer. It was shortly after I joined the company, about 72, I think, 72. I think bomb scares are sort of just coming into fashion, and some chap called up the head office in New York and said there was a bomb on board and his accomplice was on board, and unless they paid the ransom, they would send a message to him and tell him to trigger the bomb. And it didn't matter if he blew himself up, because he was going to die of cancer or something like that. The whole story. And the New York office, they relayed that message to the owners in London, which at that time was Trafalgar House. They had taken over the company trial. And the chairman there, you know, sort of took it seriously and informed the MOD, and they analysed it and thought this could be for real, and they sent out some bomb disposal expert to do it. And
where was the ship at this period in time?
We're in the mid-Atlantic, you know, we're a few days out of New York on the way home, and it was, the message came through, the company had some sort of code in those days, you know, it was before email, and it was very, it was kept very quiet about this. I mean, I was a second officer, so I was on watch with a senior officer. The senior officers were party to the threat, but me as a junior officer wasn't. So, you know, the captain had come up to the bridge and call the first officer out onto the wing and have a sort of hush-hush conversation and come back in and say, well, what's all that about? And so change the subject, you know. So, but you knew something was going on, but you couldn't put your finger on it. And then about an hour before anything happened, you know, where like the ship slowed down and the airplanes came out, the captain announced it to the passengers, said, you know, there's been a bomb scare, it's all going to happen. And the airplanes would be arriving any minute. And of course, with that, everyone dashed out on deck. It was appalling weather. And the cloud level was only about 400 feet, you know, which is below the parachuting level. You know, they need
more. The limits, yeah.
They need more than that. So these there were three Marines and a bomb disposal expert from the army. The three were there to get the other one on board, if you like. And I actually went out in the boat, and when these guys parachuted into the water, we went out and picked them up and brought them on. But all this is happening so quickly, you know, and every passenger on the deck, and you know, it was like, well, the experts on board says nothing to worry about, you know, so just life gone normal. And of course,
back to the bar.
Yeah, virtually. And they had a good look round, and there was nothing. There was a few unidentified suitcases, which they used some of the equipment to open these, blow them open. But it was nothing. It was just unidentified personal effects. So there was no scare. No reality to the scare, rather. The FBI, they did get somebody. They did send him to prison.
Okay, so it originated in the US, yeah.
Because I think what they did, they took a bag of money to the rendezvous and
the guy who turned up, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think it was, you know. I suppose it would be reasonable to say it was, in those days, it was a little bit ill thought out. You know,
wasn't particularly sophisticated.
Yeah. Whereas if it happened today, you'd say, oh, just a load of bumbling idiots, you know, to try that, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got to keep it relative to the time, you know. Yeah, so we got over that one, yeah.
Fascinating, yeah. Fascinating. Okay, so your time on the vessel came to an end when and how? Because I believe you were eyeing retirement, and you got a tap on the shoulder asking you if you'd be interested in another project.
Yeah, well, the normal retiring age of for the captains on the ships was at 61, I was like 58, so I had like 3 years to go. I was always emotionally prepared for that. I wasn't going to fall into a trap where, you know, now I'm retired, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I always had plenty of things going. And, you know, my wife and I knew we were going to retire, and we planned all sorts of things, what we were going to do and travel and stuff like that. And then then out of the blue, the owners, the CEO came and said he wanted to have a working breakfast with me when we're down in Cape Town, I think. And Kim had already gone ashore shopping, of course. And they said, you know, we're going to build this new ship, the Queen Mary, and we'd like you to stay, to be the captain of it. And, you know, in microseconds, the whole thing went through. And they hadn't even put the drawings in at that stage, you know. It was, so this could be ages and ages. Anyway, I said, yes, I could do that. And then told my wife when she came, I said, yeah. No change.
I think there's really only one answer to an opportunity like that. There's only one answer. Yes, and we'll work out the details later.
Yeah. So, instead of retiring in 2001, I retired in 2006, 5 years later. And in 2003, you know, I did half of the world cruise, and then when the ship got to Singapore, I left there and for the last time as captain. And then I went straight over to France, where the ship was being built, you know, set up a team there. I had an apartment over there and was there right until the ship was finished. You know, and that was a very exciting time. Very busy again, of course, it's always busy. But, you know, this ship was enormous, you know, it dwarfed the QE2. And the construction was totally different. You know, it was all built in, you know, like Lego, bits and pieces, you know, although it didn't. It was built in an enormous, great, long dry dock. And there were about three or four other ships in there already. And they, as they were finished, they just flooded the dock and floated the bits down until it... We got to the gate, but it embraced all the latest technology that was absolutely up to date of the day, you know, and especially with the azipod propulsions and communication systems, control systems, you know, absolutely everything was in that ship. And you know, I remember when we first sailed from San Jose when the check was handed over to the yard from the owners, and it's the right to yours. You've got a little lever, you know, not much bigger than a pen. You twiddle that, and off we go. Yeah, it was incredible.
It's incredible technology. Yeah. Were you involved in any of the design aspects? Were you consulted, like bridge layout and things like that?
Not as much as I would have liked.
Okay.
The bridge was, I'm not sure who the actual designer of the bridge was, but a lot of companies like who did it, like Kelvin Hughes, they have sort of layouts and they proposed a layout, and that was approved by somebody in the Cunard office in New York. So I didn't actually see that until it was agreed. And if I had seen it, I wouldn't have agreed to it, because there were some ergonomic issues there that weren't the best for us. But unfortunately, from what I know, it wasn't agreed by somebody who'd held a position as a master. You know? So shortly after I retired, they did modify one of the main failures was the actual width of the bridge wings. You know, when the ship was going alongside, your vision was obstructed by the lifeboats, which partly hung over the side. You couldn't see the side, so they did extend those out and about another 4 or 5 feet. You know, after retired, so little things like that. I was consulted on the position of the lifeboats because the rules had changed, and you know, I put various papers in on that. Yeah, there were some good features about the design, but you know, some weren't the easiest to work with. But, you know, a magnificent ship, you know, enormous ship, very nice, lots of good things about it, more good than bad.
Yeah. I mean, from my point of view, it, in some respects, it's the ship that we all thought would never be built. You know, we all kind of thought that the QE2 would be the end of the liners, in the traditional sense, if you will.
You're probably one of 99.99% who have the same opinion, including me. I never thought it would ever happen. And it only happened, in my view, because Carnival Corporation purchased purchased the company, Cunard Line, and they had the resources to be more diversified and ambitious with the type of ships they built, because the Carnival company, there's a Carnival cruise line, and lots of people didn't know that there was much more to it. But if you look at Carnival Corporation, they had the cruise line, and they had Holland America, they had parts of Princess Cruises, you know, many other companies already, you know, but they kept the brand separate, you know. So once we got into their corral, you know, there was they could be a bit more speculative with how they distributed their assets, you know. It's like more of a diverse portfolio, if you like.
Okay.
They built the ship and went on to build other ships, the Queen Elizabeth and Victoria. And they've got one in the shipyard now, another one. You know, Carnival Corporation is the biggest passenger shipping company in the world, you know, with well over 100 ships, you know, probably at least a dozen on order.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see what happens over the next few months and years with the current COVID situation, to see how the cruising industry and the passenger industry recovers.
Well, I feel positive that it will recover. To feel any different way would be contrary to the thoughts of the founder of Cunard Line, Samuel Cunard. Samuel Cunard, who is a Canadian, he founded the company, which, interestingly enough, is one of the very few commercial organizations in the world today that still uses the name of the founder as the name of the company. So Samuel Cunard had this vision of building a fleet of steamships to cross the Atlantic. And this was at a time in 1839, 1840, when the clipper ships were incredibly successful, going very fast across the Atlantic and round the Horn. And he wanted to build a paddle steamer, and you know, no one would give him any money in Canada, and no one in America. So he jumps on a boat and goes over to Scotland and raises the funds. And before you know it, we've got the paddle steamer Britannia crossing the Atlantic. And then once everyone saw, oh, that's a good idea, we'll have some of those, you know, European country in America and Canada, they're all building ships, you know. So it was his sort of determination, resilience, and firmness in his beliefs that created the company that lives to this day. And I always felt the same in Cunard. I mean, we had our ups and downs, but I always felt, you know, this is, we've got to stay positive here. So yeah. Stay positive with Carnival. You know, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
At some stage.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. I mean, speaking back to, we spoke about the commercial aspects earlier on of running a ship. I do remember Stephen Payne, the naval architect of the Queen Mary II. He came to Newcastle University, came to speak at a joint branch meeting of the Institute of Marine Engineering, Science and Technology and Royal Institute of Naval Architects in the Northeast. And he gave a fascinating talk where he spoke about the trade-offs that he had to do to make the vessel work from a commercial point of view. And then, you know, maybe from an aesthetic point of view, he didn't particularly want certain things, but from a commercial point of view, one of the things I remember was the number of balcony cabins, because they're prime real estate and you get quite a lot of money for those. So the vessel was designed to try and maximize the number of balconies.
Yeah, well, I knew and know Stephen very well because we were in France together, and he did come on the ship a number of times during the planning stages. And, you know, Mickey Harrison, who was head of Carnival at the time, he was one of the pioneers of balcony cabins, if you like. And I remember him saying, you know, virtually throwing Stephen's plans out. He said, come back when you've got more balconies or don't bother, you know.
And that's pretty much a story that Stephen told to us, so yeah.
Yeah, so his presentations are incredible. And he's written a book too. I think it's the old Haynes Manual, isn't it? How to...
Oh, okay. Haynes Manual for the QM2, yeah. And also some of the interesting from a technology point of view as well, the gas turbines, you know, for that peak power load rather than putting another engine in. And there's some interesting technology solutions on board.
Yeah, but again, you know, you've got the gear there, then somebody in the office says, well, you know, we don't want you to use the gas turbines because the gas is more expensive and things like that, you know. So you're always... sometimes you're in between the devil and the deep blue sea there. You want to keep the voyage going, but you're told to do this. And in the old days, when I joined Cunard in 1970, we crossed the Atlantic in 4.5 days on this Queen Elizabeth II, which was pretty fast, you know, 28 knots, and averaging that in most weather conditions. And you know, often we were late, and then we stretched it to 5 days, and then it got to 6. And you know, when the Queen Mary 2 came out, they now do it in 7. You know, it was from a heritage point of view, and I think the heritage of Cunard is important. It was fracturing the heritage to go slower, to my mind, but it made commercial sense. You know, we were always able to arrive on time. You know, we arrived in the mornings, not late at night, and people catch their onward travel, and we didn't use as much fuel and things like that. You know, so here we are with the gas turbines. Sometimes they use them, sometimes they don't.
Oh, it's interesting, I suppose, as the vessels, the transatlantic crossing kind of has changed from a mode of transportation to almost like a leisure activity, as opposed to, you know, get there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, well, QE2, if you remember, came out in 69, and that was when Concorde was taking to the skies. You know, they were testing that, and a lot of people felt that the QE2 should never have been built anyway, because the aeroplanes were there and the passenger carry of the old Queens had dropped off so dramatically, they were just totally uneconomical. So that's why when they built the QE2, they built with the flexibility of being able to go cruising a lot, you know, so she could do that in the winter and stick to the Atlantics. But when the Concorde came out, that was really an extraordinary situation, because the airlines were our competitors, but the Concorde became our ally, because we sold the crossing. If you book first class one way on the ship and a free Concorde trip back. You know, at one time Cunard were one of the biggest, we were the biggest charter of Concorde. So, you know, so they could easily fill it up with 50 people wanting that package. If you had a below first class, you could pay a little premium to go on it. So it was incredible for us, you know, that the Concorde. And of course, there was the argument from the businessman in London or New York, well, I can't afford to have 5 days out to the office, if you like. Well, if you could combine the crossings with a weekend, you know, he only lost a couple of days and he was back on the airplane. He's there before anyone knew he'd gone. You know?
All of a sudden it becomes a viable alternative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when she failed, it was a sad loss for us.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I do remember growing up seeing the advertisements in newspapers, kind of, it being on my bucket list to do that kind of combined crossing one day. But unfortunately, both vessels, ship and plane, retired before I could get the money together.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was fascinating. So I suppose there's one other ship that I think needs to get mentioned here, and you've never been on board, but I believe you've seen it, and that's Titanic.
Yeah, that was an amazing set of circumstances. I was never really all that interested in the Titanic. You know, everybody knew something about it, but it wasn't one of my particular interests. But when I joined Cunard Line, it was one of the FAQs, you know, passengers will want to know where it was and this. So I did some swatting up and I read the Night to Remember, the famous Walter Lord book and stuff. And so I had a sort of passing interest in it. And when it was discovered, that caused quite a lot of disharmony in the Titanic aficionados, because one of the earliest associations was the Titanic Historical Society, which was based in the United States, Massachusetts, I think. And then when the ship was discovered, they took the view that it's a grave and no one should ever go and see it or retrieve anything from it. But a lot of their members, including some of their executives, didn't agree. So they parted company and they started another organization called Titanic International. So when a passenger came on board and was interested in Titanic, which was always somebody, I'd have to sort of sound them out to find out which side of the fence they were on. Because, I didn't want to...
Which party did they belong to?
upset anyone. Because I'm all for retrieval. You know, I'm all for the retrieval of anything on the wreck. It is a grave for some, but so was the Egyptian burial sites, Tutankhamun and all those. You know, they don't fill those in again, do they? You know, so that was it. Anyway, I was crossing the ocean one trip and this passenger asked me, you know, what would you like to see it? And I just thought she just a casual question. And I said, yeah, it'd be nice. And, you know, she passed on. And then the next thing, I get a call from the office, the purser's office. So there was a lady who wants to give you a ticket. I went down and lo and behold, she was traveling to New York to go. She bought this ticket for the dive. And she bought it on an auction on the London radio station. I think it was Save a London Child or something. She'd bid, but she didn't want to fly over to Newfoundland. So she caught the ship. And then when she was on, she thought she changed her mind. So she gave me the ticket. And so that's how I got to go down there in 2001. Amazing.
That's incredible. And what was that experience like? I mean, it's...
It was, you know, I knew that the ships were diving on it, you know, because we, you know, always got the alerts if there's anything happening. We didn't go very near the wreck site very often on the way across, and depending on the weather, you know, if the weather was good, you could go a bit nearer to the site. You know, it was just a fascinating experience to go there. I flew out to Newfoundland. My wife came with me on the trip, but not on the dive. And we went down there, and it was, I mean, as an engineer, you'll understand it. We're in this bath escape, you know, which is probably about 2 meters in diameter, with the steel, you know, cylindrical, and the steel must have been, well, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 centimeters thick. And then it's surrounded by all sorts of other bits and pieces, which make it look like a submersible, except you're actually going down in this sphere. But it took 2.5 hours to get down to this. It's not tethered, it's just free fall. 2.5 hours. And then, you know, once you get below the surface on the way down, it's pitch black, you know, it's just nothing to see at all. And they had floodlights, but you didn't want to use the batteries up until you got down there. But that time went just incredibly quickly, because you're surrounded by this technology that enables you to do these things which were unheard of in the old days, you know, in a small machine, you know, going down, and all the equipment it had. It was just amazing. We got down there, and we stopped by the bow and had a good look around for 5 hours and up again. It was just an amazing experience. Amazing.
That's incredible. It was one of my, I don't know what year was it discovered, was it 84 or something, 85? Yeah. I think that they discovered it, and I was quite young at the time. I was still in school, and but it had been something that it caused quite a stir, and I've always been interested. And of course, the last port of call being essentially Cork,
yeah,
my hometown, on the way across the Atlantic. It's always it's always had a kind of a special place in my mind. Speaking of which, you were supposed to be in Cove this year, weren't you?
I'm president of the British Titanic Society now, and we have a convention every year. Sometimes it's most of the time it's in Southampton. We had it in Belfast a few years back, and up in Alnwick a few years ago. And this year it was going to be in Cork, but because of the virus situation, we've had to cancel it. But having said that, everybody's been really nice to us over there, and they refunded all our costs. And I was taking the car over because we were going to bookend it with some other tours there, and everything's refunded, and they've accepted our bookings for next year. So we're going to hopefully have it over there. So I'm looking forward to that. I have been there before, because in 2012, I was on the Titanic Memorial Cruise, one of the Fred Olsen ships went over there, and we stopped there on the way, which was pretty fascinating. Yeah.
They've done a wonderful job with the ticket office and the departure area. They've turned it into a fabulous museum, kind of a visitor experience now.
Yeah.
The original pier is still there in the water, just outside that.
But the other thing there, of course, is one of the things I wanted to look at when I go back, is the Lusitania elements, you know, because there's graves there of the Lusitania.
That's correct, yeah.
Cunard ship, and probably heard that the owner of the wreck has given it to the city. He died
a
year or two ago, Bemis. So he's left the wreck to Ireland, which is nice.
Yeah. That's very nice. Yeah, there's a memorial in one of the squares there, which is just across from the old White Star Line office.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's up on the hill in the cemetery, there's a mass grave for those the bodies that weren't claimed.
My son is he didn't come to see, but his passion is not his profession, but his passion is diving, and he does a lot of that, and well over 1,000 dives, you know, very experienced, different, and, you know, does rebreathers now. But in diving, his speciality was shipwrecks. That was his favorite thing. And a few years ago, he wrote a book called Shipwrecks of Cunard Line. He dived on, not on the Lusitania, of course, but he dived on many Cunard Line ships in different parts of the world, you know, with photographs and stuff. Yeah, and he helped me with the fourth edition of the QE2 book, you know, I was able to do it, but I said, well, you have it, take the copyright. And he said, well, only if we do it together.
Excellent. Excellent. So when was this? So we've got the fourth edition of your existing book, which is available.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's available on Amazon and things like that.
Yeah, it's all those places. Oh, that's good. I'll have that. Excuse me.
Don't fall.
I've just got a cup of tea brought to me.
Oh, there you go. They're service, eh?
Amazing. Yeah, it's on there, on Amazon, yeah. Yeah, so it's the first edition came out in 1983, and then I updated, and then it as each edition sold out, and then around about 2002, I think it was 2001, the third edition sold out, so the Cunard, you know, who were quite happy with it, asked if I was going to revise it again. And I didn't have the time, you know, because I was heavily involved with the Queen Mary too by then. So it just went on the back burner. Then when Sam had finished his one of his shipwreck books, I said, well, you know, you take it. Anyway, he decided he wanted to do it together. So
very good. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Listen, Ron, it's been fascinating to speak with you. I mean, it goes without saying that if you ever happen to be out in this part of the world, please do let me know.
Tell me a little bit about the QE2 then. Have you been there many times?
I've been on board about 4 or 5 times now, I think, in the past year.
It's closed at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, they closed it towards the end of March, I think, with the COVID situation. They closed it until September. So it opened to the public, kind of a soft opening, in I think it was April of last year. Yeah. No, April of 18, maybe.
Yeah.
And kind of, there was a lot, which I particularly liked. There was a lot of the original ships still there. They hadn't really done a lot to it. Some of the cabins, I think, had been kind of brought up to hotel spec, if you will. But things like the Queen's Grill was still as it was. I would imagine when you walked off the vessel back in 2008 or whenever it was, you were on board.
Yeah, well, I retired in 2006, and then the agency for the new owners contacted me and said, you know, would I be interested in taking over when it was handed over in 2008, because they wanted to take, they talked about just taking it to Singapore at the time. It was never fully disclosed. So I agreed. So I actually sailed on the last voyage to Dubai. And then when the check was paid and it was handed over, I took over, and I had a squad of men. But by the time it got to Dubai, you know, that was the year of the big economy collapse. The Dubai World said, well, we're not going to start any new projects till we've finished what we've already got going. So everything was put on hold, and the ship never was going to go anywhere. So they said they don't need me now after a couple of months. So I was on there on my own. Well, I just had 39 men, you know, it was amazing. And you could walk around the ship without seeing anybody, you know, because you've got, with 39, you've got some watchkeepers, got some asleep and stuff like that. So there's nobody. And it was really an amazing experience to be on there without passengers, because, you know, right, when you're walking through the ship, you're always conscious of a passenger and it's good morning or hello or something. Whereas when there's nobody there, your eyes are looking at totally different things, you know. And I just had the sort of little pocket camera. So I went to shore in Dubai and bought one of these big SLR jobs, package ones, and I set about trying to take a time capsule, I suppose. I must have taken about 3,000 photos around the ship from top to bottom, you know, from the top of the mast and funnel right down into the engine room. You know, it was really quite amazing. And also, you know, if you look at the websites, people get really uptight about it and say we should have kept it and everything. But when you look at it with a sort of professional eye, or professional seaman's eye in my case, you realise it was a good time to sell it. You know, there's a lot of things wrong with that ship. You know, and in terms of commercial elements, you know, you can't compete with a new ship and an old ship like that. You know, and there's people who always like the old, but it wouldn't have worked. Yeah.
I mean, from my perspective going on board, I was really pleased that I got to see a lot of the original elements of the vessel before they changed some of the areas. For example, the Queen's Grill. I think you saw the photographs that I posted on Facebook of the changes to the Queen's Grill. I think they've done a really good job. I think it's very sympathetic and in keeping with the look and the feel of the vessel. I believe, and you would know better than me, forward of the Queen's Grill, was there a wardroom there? Was it the officers' wardroom?
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've converted that into a new lounge bar, which is associated with the Queen's Grill. And then the Queen's Grill has been renovated. They've decked over the well that was in the middle of the floor of the Queen's Grill. So it's all one level now. But the decor and the lighting is all kind of art deco in there. So it is kind of in keeping with the feel of the ship.
You know, I sort of lurk around on the Facebook pages. You know, I try not to get too involved unless there's something I really want to know. But what surprises me is how many people are upset with what's happened, and, you know, to the extent you get disparaging remarks about the owners of what they've done. And I think that's rather sad. And a lot of the crew were on there for many, many years, and I can imagine they're upset to a degree. But a lot of these crew that's, you know, maybe spent 10 or 15 years on there, or even more, they would go home on leave for a refit, and then come back and the whole ship's changed. Oh, that's okay. You know, they never mind. But once it goes to a new owner, they want it to stay exactly the same.
Yeah, they don't want their memory to be altered, shall we say. Yeah.
Like the Queen's Grill that you mentioned, that when the ship first came out, that was known as the 736 Club. That was a nightclub. You know, and when QE2 first went into service, ships trading into America weren't allowed to have casinos on board. Then they revoked that rule, probably in the late 69 or early 70s. So Cunard promptly cleared out the nightclub and put the casino in there, you know. And then eventually, you know, when they had more time, they put it downstairs where one of the libraries was, and then made that into a grill, and then added the penthouses. You know, so many changes there. It's quite amazing. Yeah.
I'm trying to think about it. So they've also, just before they closed, I think they were just about to start doing bridge tours. So they had not modified the bridge, but they had made it visitor friendly, shall we say. I think there was kind of Perspex panels put over the switches and things like that. And I think if you were staying on board, I think the tour would be for free, and there was a relatively cheap amount if you wanted to come in off the street, because they've built a reception area, which is kind of a small museum as well.
Yeah,
on the to the vessel.
Yeah.
Which is, again, I think they've done a great job. I think the long-term idea is that whole area of the port will get redeveloped into a more residential type area with a yacht marina as well, as opposed to the kind of commercial working port that it is almost at the moment. And the QE2 is kind of the catalyst for that, if you will, to start all of that change and renovation in that area.
Yeah, I've seen some pictures out there of the Perspex guarding the instruments and the bridge. But I also heard they totally wiped out stripped out the captain's cabin, which is one deck below. And that's all gone.
Okay, I didn't hear that, but yeah, so it's quite possible.
Yeah. So when they were about to open it, somebody contacted me through a Facebook page, my daughter's Facebook page, because I didn't have one. And they said, you know, would I be interested in going there for the opening? So I said, of course, yeah, happy to do that. But they had what they called a soft opening, and then it never happened. And I think that chap that was going to invite me over disappeared.
Yeah, I think it was I think they, understandably so, they wanted to get open and start making some money, because it's they paid something like $100,000, $100 million for the vessel up front or something like that.
But I'd really like to go on board. I'd like to have another look around. Yeah. You know, I mean, the changes don't worry me. You know, it's, have you ever been on the Queen Mary in Long Beach?
I haven't.
And that's changed it dramatically. But what is dramatic about that ship is when you walk along the dock and you just see this seething mass of riveted plates. You know, the grandeur's still there, although bits and pieces inside. And I think that's the message that QE2 will deliver. It's a grand ship. I mean, they took the lifeboats off and all hell was let loose from a lot of it.
That's right. Yeah.
But, you know, to my mind, that was a good thing, because, you know, being an engineer, you'll understand problems with welding two bit of steel and aluminium together, wouldn't you? The davits for the boats were connected, which were made of steel, were connected to the aluminium superstructure.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of trouble on there with the bimetallic joints, you know, corrosion building up. And those boats, if they were just left there, would just eventually, the weight would just pull those davits off and you could have a terrible accident. So, I mean, that was a pretty sensible thing to do.
You know, I think when you consider that most, it doesn't matter. I mean, you go back, you think of, I don't know, the Mauritania or many, many other vessels that would be iconic in their own right. They all ended up as razor blades and as tin cans, you know. So I think we're lucky to still have the vessel, in no matter what shape it's in, you know. And I think the owners are quite sympathetic to a lot of the features on board.
Well, to my mind, it was a really good decision when I heard that Dubai bought it, because it, you know, could never have survived in England. I was involved with a consortium that wanted to bring it back when they thought that Dubai may want to pass it on, but it would never have been successful over here. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of money to maintain a ship like that.
Yeah.
So you out there for the duration, and are you permanently in?
Yeah, I moved out here a little over a year ago. My wife had been out here for 2 years before that, with her job, and I had been I was self-employed. I was finishing up a contract in the UK. I was doing subsea electricity interconnector between Belgium and the UK.
Oh, okay.
And when that project finished, we had to make a decision. You know, would I come to Dubai or would she come back to the UK? And I was like, come on, let's give it a go. I mean, my wife is German.
Yeah.
So neither one of us is from the UK originally. So it was a little bit like, okay, let's go for the next adventure.
Yeah.
So yeah, pretty much a year I was here now, enjoying it. It's very different. It was quite a change when I first came out. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's strange at the moment, as is everywhere. I mean, we're living in unusual times and life is far from normal. But yeah, I was saying, you know, 25 degrees in January, I think I can cope with that. Yeah, yeah. Why did you pick Somerset for home? Is there a particular reason, or you like the area?
Well, I lived in mainly lived up in Surrey in the old days. And then I had a property in Ascot. And then when I met with my wife, she was probably the only American I ever met in my life, and I met thousands on the ships that had no desire whatsoever to come to England and see the Queen and the changing of the guards and all that. And so I asked her if she'd come over, and she said no. Anyway, finally persuaded. I thought, well, a little two up and two down in Ascot's not no good. So I rented a cottage in this village in Nunney, which had, you know, beams of wood burning stone, old-fashioned plumbing with a bath with legs and a pub and a castle in the village. So all the trappings, you know, the American dream over 5 years old. So she came over. Then she moved over when we got married, and because we'd come here first, we used to come down here and sort houses. So we bought it. It's about 30 years ago now. Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. Well, where did you meet Kim?
In an airport in Los Angeles. Yeah, because she used to work for Thai Airlines, and she was flying all over the place with them. In sales. And I was, at that particular time in my career, I would do so many months on one ship, then move to another, you know, so I was always flying around to different ships, joining them. And so I was at the airport she was at the airport, and not talking.
The rest is history, as they say, yeah?
Yeah, which is very good.
Yeah, so any parting thoughts, Ron? What's the future hold?
Well, you know, I'm retired. I've got more stuff to do than I've got time for. You know, it's, you know, probably not a good time to have started the Falkland thing, but it's interesting, you know, and it shaking up people's memories of things they've got, you know. And I mean, I had a chap who was worked in the shops. We kept a couple of shopkeepers on the ship for the Falklands, because they, you know, they had their toothpaste and chocolate bars they could buy and stuff. And you know, in the questionnaire I said any particular memorable events, and this chap wrote and said, yeah, he was in the shop one day and one of the guards came in, the Grenadier Guards or whatever they were, and said, you know, lost money on the cards, you know. could he borrow £10, you know, and this chap, you know, he didn't want to lend him the money, you know, and you know, would never have done an enormous, but then he thought, well, you know, this chap's going to war and, you know, it might be his last gamble. So he gave him the £10 and he said he never expected to see it again. But the next day the guy came up and said, I had a good night. Amazing, you know.
Fabulous.
Amazing, you know, little story. The what's interesting about this whole Falkland thing is how much went on that I didn't know about, you know, behind, not necessarily behind the scenes, but in every, you know, I mentioned earlier, it was a very busy, you know, and I think, well, why didn't I know that? I know I would never have had time, you know. you know, so, but all these other little areas where different things are happening. So it's really an interesting exercise. You know, a lot of people are dead now, of course, but
yeah, because as you said, we're coming up on 40 years in a couple of years' time. Yeah,
so there's about three websites or Facebook pages with South Atlantic, and some of the stuff coming up out now is pretty good. You know, and
yeah,
I've contacted people and they responded. And, yeah, you know, I just need to get like a couple of anecdotes from some of the survivors. I think that would be nice. Mm-hmm. More of the
survivors. So what's your timeline for that, Ron? When are you trying to get that finished?
It'll be 40 years in 2 years, in 2022. So if it's got to be out for that, it's got to be ready at least a year in advance. I'm still trawling for information and gathering. So I've got a fairly good idea in mind how the book's going to be structured. But I haven't started looking for a publisher yet, but I want a publisher that will give me flexibility, because I think it's going to have a lot of photographs. I think that it's going to be photograph led, I think, in a way. Because photographs are important, you know, when you see pictures of soldiers running around the deck with all their gear on their back, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. with somebody else on their back, you know, struggling across their kit bag, you know, they're rescuing, you know, and then messing around with their machine guns on deck and practicing and the Gurkhas, all that, you know, there's a big story there, you know, and you can't describe a soldier running around the deck with a man on his back in words. You need that picture, don't you? Yeah.
So, yeah. And if you have the picture, why not use it? Yeah.
So I've got it. I'm working on that. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Okay. So you reckon about 1 year? 1 year is your deadline?
Yeah, it has to be because most publishers need a year. You know, unless we go down as some sort of self-publishing route. It's not about the money, it's about the record. You know, I went to the War Museum last year and it was very disappointing. I thought they'd have more information about the ship, but they didn't. You know, and I think it just needs to be put together. So, you know, if it's published like on Amazon or something like that, I don't mind.
Yeah, there are so many different routes at this point to try and publish.
I've got the crew list. I've got the name of everybody who was on that voyage. You know, 600 of, you know, so it'll be dedicated to them, you know. And it's the time, you know, there's people out there that, you know, and these websites, these Facebook pages, and you know, some kids found a medal in his late father's box or something and want to know what it's all about, you know. Sad, they don't know.
They don't know. Well, as I said before, I mean, if there's anything I can do to help with regards to once the QE2 opens up again, photographs, there's a few plaques there in addition to the one that I've already sent.
That was the only one I can remember about the Falklands, wasn't it?
I think so.
So that was good. You know, I might have had one, but you know, I don't take photos, I take snaps. so my pictures around the ship, and a lot of that stuff was put away anyway when we went to depart. So I didn't actually see that. So
that particular plaque that I sent you, the photograph, that was displayed on board.
Yes. That was in on two deck forward in one of the foyers there for a long time. Yeah. And then there was the exchange of the messages between the Queen Mother and the captain, you know, which was in silver. I think they're probably in the entrance for on the dock, aren't they? Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, quite possibly. Thank you so much for your time, Ron. I greatly appreciate it. It's been absolutely fascinating to chat with you.
Oh, good.
I think we've touched some interesting topics from engineering to design to the commercial aspects of the ship to some of your interesting personal stories.
One of my son's other project, he wants to write a book about my father and me. So he's trawling for all the bio.
I think that would be a very good subject for a book. As you said, it's a unique situation. All right. Well, listen, by all means, please feel free to stay in touch. If there's anything I can do to help. And if you ever plan on visiting us here in Dubai, please do let me know.
Okay then, Shane. Cheers. Thanks.
All right. Great to meet you, Ron. Thank you very much for your time. Now.